Hey everyone, I'm Tony, your host of the Grounded Podcast. This podcast is all about sustainable living, urban and not so urban living, homesteading and healthy eating with a healthy dash of permaculture principles and environmentalism. This podcast came from a blog I started nearly two decades ago after accidentally stumbling into gardening while in my mid-teens three decades ago. And I've been hooked ever since. Now, aside from being a foodie, hippie, hipster, film pundit, traveler, 80s enthusiast, self-proclaimed chef, and I do mean self-proclaimed chef, I'm also a homesteader, an urban homesteader. Now, most importantly, I'm a father, small business owner, organic gardener, and just too much more to name here. So welcome to my sustainable yet attainable home garden.
Indeed. So how's your day looking so far?
It's Friday. It's sunny. I cannot complain.
It's sunny. I've got clouds. Nothing but clouds. The rain has just moved out. There's flooding everywhere.
I got through the flood phase. We are looking at a lovely weekend.
Okay. So hopefully the sun is coming my way. You're not too far from me. So hopefully the sun is coming my way and I get a little bit of that. Hopefully.
That's right. I'll keep my fingers crossed for you.
Okay. Knock on wood. I need a nice sunny day. All right. So what is today's topic, Michelle?
I'm going to let you know. Gardening myths, I believe.
Debunked. These long held on to basically lies. I don't know. Lies.
I think lies is a little harsh. I think a lot of people live their lives thinking, I want to do this thing. Is there an easier way for me to jump into it to avoid this problem or improve this yield or whatever? And I think that these are just, you know, shortcuts or hacks that may not be quite as successful as it was implied.
Right. Yeah.
So lie is a little harsh, maybe.
Lies. There are lies. Okay. I'll go with your take on it. It's nicer. It's softer. You have to, you know,
that's right.
Force people into these things. So, you know, but it doesn't make the journey that we're about to go down for the next 30 minutes or so any easier. Because these are like, no, my grandma told me these, and you know, whenever grandma
one of them is from my grandma, so yeah.
I have about two or three of these that are on the list that are from my grandma, so yeah. it's like if she told you these, you know, these things, and she's been doing these for 50, 60 years or whatever, however long she was gardening, then they must be true, and because right. They worked for her because she did them for so long. But I always say, just because you've been doing something for a long time,
right,
doesn't mean you've been doing it the right way all that time, right?
Right.
All right. So we're going to jump into the myths. I'm going to let you start off, and then we'll just go from there.
Okay. Well, my first one is my grandma one, and she had an ongoing battle with slugs and snails.
Oh, yeah.
And her go-to was a pan of beer. Mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. draw them in to drown. I've heard it over and over. I bet somebody just left a beer in the garden one time and they saw a slug drowned in it the next day and they were like, holy cow, I have found the holy grail of
right.
eliminating slugs. But experts say that it is marginally successful. So like, yes, they enjoy the smell of the beer and they come over. But no more than any other slug bait kind of situation. And so it's not the holy grail for keeping snails and slugs out of your garden.
Yeah. I think some of that comes from, you know, like you said, someone probably just left the beer out somewhere. It's like, oh, that, you know, they went into it and they got, you know, drowned. You know, I think it comes from some of the yeast. I think that's what they're attracted to. But a lot of that is naturally flying around the air. You know, whenever you think about when you're doing sourdough bread and all those,
sure.
you know, it's like that's, it's kind of like the same thing. So it's hard. And I know the science is kind of like still out on it. But right now, we can definitely put it in the debunked category. So
okay.
In debunked. All right, what you got next on your list?
Another one, it's more of an arborist kind of situation, but,
gotcha.
And I grew up with this too, where when my dad would prune a tree or trim a tree, he would paint that open wound on the tree with, you know, pine tar or a treatment to, I guess, protect the tree and help it survive the pruning. But everybody agrees, again, when you talk to experts, that that doesn't do anything.
Right.
It doesn't protect the tree. Yeah.
No, no, absolutely.
It may assuage your guilt from cutting his arm off. But
right. That's it. Makes you feel better. But it really doesn't have any benefit for the tree or shrub, right, or whatever you're cutting.
They have a natural defense mechanism against, you right. know, losing a limb like that. So
just like us, you know, except we don't pull back limbs, but we, you know, it heals and, you know, those antibodies and everything go to that area and it cures it really quickly. But yeah.
Right. Right. I have another tree one.
Oh, go.
So when you plant a seedling, a lot of people want to support it and help it have the maximum chance of success, and they will stake a tree. But really, trees have been growing for millennia without staking by anybody. They just sprout up. Unless they are an insanely top-heavy tree, there's no reason to stake them. And that's ultimately what it comes down to.
Yep. And if they're top heavy like that and they're going to fall over, then what's going to happen is they're going to fall back into that, you know, natural cycle of, you know, decomposing and becoming a part of the landscape. So it really doesn't, you know, if it's like, if it's going to survive, it's going to survive. And I do this a lot with my permaculture gardening, because I do a little bit of that forest area. And whenever I have things that are in that area in particular, it's like, you know, I'll plant, you know, probably like I'll grab 100 pumpkin seeds, right?
And sure.
I may have only 10 of them survive, because I just naturally just let them do what they're going to do. And the ones that are going to survive, you know, and that are prosperous and they, you know, thrive in that area, then those are the ones that were probably most likely going to do the best, you know.
The healthiest.
You know? Yeah. They're the healthiest. And the other ones, it's like, they may have had some issues from the get-go. So it's like, yep, that's nature, you know, taken care of.
You can't know. Save them all.
Right. And us just coming in, just trying to, you know, try to save everything and baby everything. It's like, no, you know, and that's one thing, you know, whenever I'm talking to someone who's gardening for the first time and they're trying to set up and establish everything, I'm like, don't baby anything. Whenever you plant that seedling in or whatever you have, don't, you know, just like, you know, with kid gloves on, so to speak.
Yep.
Fine. Put it in the ground. It's like, no, just put it in the ground, water it, you know, let it go and just, you know, watch it, you know, as it grows up. And then, you know, it's almost like the same thing you have to do with kids, right? Kind of.
Oh, yeah. Well, kinda. I mean, I'm going to try and keep them all alive, even if they seem
right, right. We're not talking about killing kids here. We're not talking about kids. But, you know, it's like you give them the life skills and you set them up for success and you watch over and maintain. And it's that same thing. You know, at some point it's like, you know, when they reach adulthood, it's like, okay, you have to let them go on their own and whatever happens, probably going to happen, but you be there for that shoulder to cry on. Anyway.
Sure.
I'll dive deeply into that. All right. Anything else you've got for me?
My last one is the beehive idea. So people are like, what do I need to make my garden super successful? I will, you know, relocate a hive, or I will bring in a hive of honeybees to pollinate my garden. They will give me honey. It's a win-win, right?
Right.
But the problem is, unless that is a native species to your area that would naturally thrive there, and it's an area where there's no other pollinators, you are starving your local pollinators and you're producing low quality honey, because those bees weren't designed to be in this area. So it may seem like a good idea or super cool, but make sure you're doing your research. If you want to have a hive, it can't just be whatever you wanted it to be. It has to be what belongs in your region.
Yep.
And it has to be done in consideration of how many other healthy populations of bees are in your area.
Exactly. Yep. You know, I do something similar to that. Not a beehive in particular, but
right.
What I like to do is just plant all these perennial and pollinating, you know, ones that will basically attract them into your garden.
Sure.
Over the years that I have so many different types of bees coming in, coming and going. And, you know, of course you have your local bees or ones that just fly in for a quick lunch or dinner or whatever, you know, it's really interesting to see just the amount of different types of pollinators you'll see coming in.
Sure. Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to jump into a few of mine, and a lot of them are rapid fire, but because I've got a few. And there could have been so many I could have done, but I'm like, nope. And what I try to do with this, I try to mix up some commonly known, not necessarily garden myths, because people don't know that they're myths, but just things that people have been doing for years, and they say, oh, well, it works for me, but it's anecdotal at best. But for me, it's like, okay, I tried to mix in a couple different, myths within, some that are really known, some not so much, and some are just plain weird, right?
Oh, I like
that. Oh, yeah, you like, well, there you go. I like weird, too. There you go. Anyone that listens to the podcast in any amount of time knows that for sure.
I see.
Okay. So, banana peels add potassium to the soil. Okay, so bananas are high in potassium, right? And I've heard people even burying in an entire banana.
Does that work?
No, it doesn't. Which for me is kind of wasteful, right? You know,
sure.
or the peels, which don't work as well in some cases, not at all.
Sure.
And with a lot of these things, I'm finding out, and over the years, in practicing and trying out some of them, there's a little bit of truth to all of them, and that's what makes them so dangerous, because it's like, oh well, it works, or it depends on your environment or wherever you're planting whatever you're planting, and then you try to apply some of these gardening myths, it's like, oh well, I had a measure of success, so obviously it works, but it doesn't work across the board. But banana peels, they basically, and the real reason it doesn't work is because you have the microorganisms in the soil that work to break down the peels themselves.
Right.
And, but what they do is they extract large amounts of nitrogen from the soil. So while you're adding very small amounts of potassium, you're also taking away large amounts of nitrogen.
Right.
Long time gardener will know, or even starting out gardener will know, that nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus are the main ingredients that are mostly used by plants, especially veggies. So exactly. Right. Those are the main nutrients in it. Everything is, and what happens is when you add that extra potassium, it tries to break it down, and it's trying to do its job. But it bounds up.
Interesting.
It bounds up that, and it doesn't let those other nutrients come in. So it just basically blocks them from coming in. So it just shuts everything down. So it's better just to add the peels to the compost pile.
That's
the gist of it. All right. So I'm gonna jump to another one. Drought tolerant plants don't need watering. I hear that.
Oh no.
The time. Okay, so
that'd be like saying a camel doesn't need water.
Right? And I've had people ask me this question or say, hey, my plant, usually succulents, it's not looking too well. It's looking like it's dying. It's like, well, first question is, how are you watering? And for years, I haven't watered it. When was the last time you watered? 2 months ago.
Weird.
that might be an issue, and it's if any plant has a root system, it needs water and certain nutrients, so if you're giving it that, it's going to die. Now some plants may require less, like I said before, succulents
or a cactus.
Yeah. But you just can't go 2 or 3.
They have good water storage systems. They're not
right
that grow sans water. Yeah. What about like an air plant, I wonder?
A what now?
An air plant.
Huh. Those, I don't know, because I've seen a lot of people talk about that in trying to connect that with hydroponics and water and both, but I'm not 100% sure. And when I say
we'll
I'm
have to sure look about into it,
I'm going to dive into it. Like I've always said, you know, a term I always hear people say is master gardening. And I'm like, I'm not a master gardener. I haven't mastered it yet. And I think I ever will. But when I say that, people get upset. Oh, I've done this. And it's like, well, if you want to be recognized for that, that's fine that you're an experienced gardener. But anyway, that's a don't ever really master it, because I know people that have been gardening for far longer than me, and they're still learning things and still, I never knew that. And some of these things are common things, or there might be newer things, and it's just, you can go down a road, but definitely. So airplane, and I've heard about that, and I've listened to a couple of things, but I'm going to definitely dive into that. And what I'll do is probably on the other side of this episode, I'll just add some information that I've researched. And whenever I do research, I usually do .edu, because that's probably the best sources.
It's
for
very things. Incredible.
Don't just dive on the internet looking for just random things, or going on Pinterest trying to find your information, because a lot of these myths, and what's so funny is I found that a lot of these myths are still talked about and told as if it's scientifically based by really respected people, some of which are doctors, which is like, how do you do that? I'm not calling out any names, I'm not calling anybody out, but it's like, wow. It's like, but when you have people that are in that position and they're saying these things, and then people are seeing this anecdotal information, it's like, that's a recipe for disaster in the garden over the lifetime of your garden. But anyway, I'm not going to dive too deeply into that, because I go off on these tangents sometimes. So I'm trying to curb that a little bit.
Okay.
All right. Another one is adding coffee grounds to help with soil pH. And there is a little bit of truth to this. And like I said, a lot of these have a little bit of truth to them. And that's what makes a lot of them really dangerous, because there's a little bit of truth mixed in with a whole bunch of, misinformation.
Sure.
So it's like, yep, this is probably not something we should be doing. But coffee grounds help to lower the pH to an acidic level. And that's why a lot of people add them to blueberries and azaleas and things that. Yeah, so coffee grounds can do that with acid-loving plants. Like I said, blueberries and azaleas, blah, 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 blah. But just like the banana peels, the coffee grinds, they can tie up nitrogen in the soil as they decompose. So it's basically the same effect.
Do it in compost?
Yeah. So throw it in the compost, be done with it, and that's the best way, because it gives it a chance to decompose in the compost, heat up, and it becomes more viable for you to use whenever you put it into the garden as compost, instead of just straight, nutrient that, the soil is trying to break down. And so you have like this little in between those times. So you have a couple of months where it can fully break down and it become really usable at that time.
Okay.
So that's all I have to say about coffee grinds. And I have a lot of them that could go into the garden, but I don't. I just don't sprinkle them.
Okay.
All right, so adding fertilizer to the hole helps transplants establish faster.
Okay.
So this is, so like I said.
This one seems complicated to me, because I heard that putting fertilizer directly on the roots of a plant could cause a burn.
Right. It can cause a burn, and some people put the put the fertilizer in the hole, put a little bit of soil on top of it, and then put the new transplant on top of it.
Sure.
But the problem with that is when you do that, you you basically create this environment where the plant doesn't have to take care of itself. It becomes dependent on those nutrients, and it doesn't, the roots don't spread out. They don't go all over the place, and they don't look for moisture, water, other nutrients, other, because that's how a plant, you know, grows and thrives.
It doesn't have to keep roots, as yeah, everything.
The roots spread out, but if all the nutrients have been right there in that little spot, it's like, no, I'm good. I'm comfortable. This is a nice little safe spot. I've got all my nutrients, everything, and it won't grow. But the problem with that also is when you do that, it'll create a plant that is unhealthy. It's disease prone. Pests will flock to it. And that's really the downside to that. So that's as far as the fertilizer, adding fertilizer to the hole, just shouldn't do it.
Don't do it.
Yeah. Now, if you want to do something, you can, like, I would say probably after about 2 weeks after that plant has gotten accustomed to where it is, because usually about 14 days is usually when the shock effect, or transplant shock, as they call it, starts to wear off and the plant is settled in its new home. You can start to side dress. And basically that's digging down an inch, maybe 2 inches, on either side of the plant, probably about 3 inches away from the transplant on both sides, sprinkle a little bit of fertilizer in so that it encourages the transplant's roots to spread out. And then you cover back over, and then you're done. You do a little bit of watering, and you're done. And then you won't have to worry about that. Probably, say, with certain kinds of veggies, you may want to dive into just transplanting certain types of I lost my thought. I was getting ready to say something really profound, and it's completely that's the thing, but editing is a thing. But you may want to do every 30 days during the growing season. That's what I was getting ready to say. You can do 30 days during the growing season. But like I said, just a little bit of side dressing, just a little bit, just encourage and keep going out and out and out. And then you won't have to do it anymore, because the growing season will probably be over by the time those, you know, subsequent 30 days have gone by.
Okay.
So with that being said, I'm going to dive into the next one. And this is one that's just like, I have never heard of this one. And this is funny for me, because it's like, I've heard so many people and so many things talking about it online. And I'm like, what? But it's adding sugar to the soil to make your tomatoes sweeter. Have you heard of this one? I've never heard of this one. I'm like, okay, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So on the surface, this may seem to make sense, you know, sugar or sugar water added to the soil. It seems like it would make sense, right? You know,
I mean, in theory, but I think bugs.
Right. It's like you're introducing all those different other, you know, what we call pests into the garden. I guess it kind of makes sense on the surface, but it really doesn't make sense. You know, tomato. But if you're doing this, don't add sugar. It just can't take up the sugar. It just can't. Doing a small cultivator.
A little too literal.
Right. It's like, but like I was about to say, just choosing a cultivator, you know, a cultivar that is basically it's more conducive to having a sweeter taste, because you don't want to just pick just these large fruit, which, you know, basically they're just not going to have the taste that you're looking for. Or consistent watering in healthy soil. These are the only reasons you'll have sweeter tomatoes.
Okay.
And, you know, tomato plants can't absorb sugar in the soil. They produce it through photosynthesis. So we know that word.
Sure.
And then there's also the predetermined genetics in the plants. So there's a couple different factors. So we just don't want to just jump into this, but photosynthesis is the only thing that, you know, will cause, or, you know, having a different cultivar or consistent water. Consistent watering is one of the biggest things you'll probably, and healthy soil, of course, but that's for everything across the board. But consistent watering. Inconsistent watering will change the taste of your tomatoes. And I've noticed this myself, just like last night, all the way until early this morning, we had these rains, and I held off on watering for about a week, and I'm glad I did that. Because, you know, because it's like I got all the water I need probably for the next 2 weeks now, so I don't need to do that. But had I went ahead and like, well, you know, it's looking a little bit dry, it's really warm, I'm gonna go ahead and water it, and had I got this watering on top of it, that may, it's not for sure, but it may have changed the taste of the tomato.
Oh, interesting.
All right, so I'm gonna dive into my last two here. I have so many others, but I'm just gonna just throw them in as like a bonus episode for tomorrow. So we're gonna have a little bit more content, probably another 20 minutes.
Ooh,
that's how I do. So it's gonna be fun. But use garlic spray as an organic pesticide.
Okay,
I hear this all the time. So garlic spray can be effective at killing what we deem to be harmful pests in our garden. But the problem is that garlic-based insecticides are broad spectrum.
Okay.
Broad spectrum pesticide. So it's non-selective, meaning it harms beneficial insects like bees and butterflies and some of the very pollinators that pollinate our veggies that we're wanting to get a large harvest from. So this is something that we probably don't want to use unless we want to kill off everything. Now, the same can't be said for peppers, because that's a little bit different, and it's a whole nother thing. And we're definitely going to dive into that a little bit later. But garlic, definitely, you don't want to use that kind of pesticide on the garden, because, like I said, it's a broad spectrum. It basically kills everything. It keeps everything away. That's why when you grow garlic or onions or anything in the, you know, allium family, it deters pests, and it usually deters everything.
Yeah, well, it smells very strong out there.
Yeah, right, exactly. So yeah, that's why one of the things I use too is BT spray, and it's you know, if I have to use it, and it's usually just on my squash, corn, or tomatoes. It's one of the three, and I don't use it all at the same time. And you only have to use it at the base of the, you know, the plants, and usually more so in the squash, because you have those vine borers. They, you know, they lay those small copper eggs, and they bury into them, and they wreak havoc. And you'll have healthy plants one day, and the next day you'll like, what happened? They look all wilted and sick, and they're, you know, turning yellow and brown and drying out. It's because of those. So. That's more hormone based. It's not anything else that's added to it. So it's something that is directly affecting just those insects, sure, those worms.
Now you did mention planting allium. Now, is there a way to utilize that, an intelligent way to keep the pests away from the garden too, but that wouldn't impact the other pollinators? You could just plant one here and there.
You can plant either onions, or you can plant garlic, and you know, and that will deter them wherever you don't want them to be. It's not as effective as, say, you know, garlic oil or something like that, but sure, you know, because you coat that with the leaves with the garlic, but it does help, because it's like, and if you start those earlier than you would the other transplants or seeds, whatever you have going into the ground, sure, it will keep them away from the very beginning, so that when you have those other crops that are starting to come up, you don't have to worry about them coming in, because they've already got the post-it note, right? It's like, oop, nope, I'm good.
We're not coming
there. We know what's over there, so they go somewhere else. And that's another reason why I plant like a little, you know, a little deterring, you know, crops in another area of the garden, so they all go and flock to that area. It's like, you eat up what you want to eat up and do what you want to do over there. All right, another area, something I want to talk about is removing the suckers from tomato plants will increase the harvest. And this was one of the ones up until like up until almost a year and a half ago, I still believed thoroughly because it made sense, and I would see the anecdotal evidence of it by my tomatoes getting larger over the course of, say, 2 weeks.
Because energy to devote to that one.
Right, right. And like I said, there's a little bit of truth to it. Oh, okay, you can do that if you want to have larger tomatoes, and it won't necessarily take away from the flavor of them, but if you want more of a harvest,
right,
don't pinch off, And, because you have those little, and everyone, if you're not too sure what I'm talking about with the suckers, it's the little tomato plants, the little small that will come up in between the shoulder of the major plants. I think it's called axils, in between, and they grow. And people usually just pinch those out so that the main stem of the plant will continue to grow and get larger and produce more flowers or more fruit. So when they, and most people say, oh, well, it steals energy from the mother plant, but nope, in fact, they usually give it more energy by absorbing the sunlight because you have more foliage, which, feeds right back into.
It protects it from the direct
light. Right, exactly. So these little suckers will actually produce more tomatoes. And recent studies have even shown that eliminating suckers tends to cause foliar diseases. So you have foliage that will have all these diseases that start turning brown, and then it'll lead to black spot and all these other things that are just absolutely horrible. And they will decimate a tomato plant within 3 or 4 days if not taken care of.
Wow.
But that's it. That's all I have to say.
Okay.
And we've got a lot of these things that have been debunked. I've got a couple small few things here, but I'm going to put those in a bonus episode, and it will be so much fun. Okay, I got two questions for you before we wrap up and get out of here.
I have two answers right. for you.
Okay, true or false? True or false?
True or false?
All right. Peeing on your lemon tree is good for it.
Me peeing on my lemon tree?
Anyone in general.
I would think in general it's okay. I don't know that it's necessarily extra beneficial.
Do you think it will create and cause more of a harvest and make the plant healthier, the tree itself healthier?
If you pee on your tone of voice, no.
True. So true.
Really? Interesting.
So much science, and I'm not going to even put everything out there. I'm just going to let people research this, and you're going to go down a rabbit hole. It's like, oh my God.
I'm not allowed to have a lemon tree in South Carolina, so I won't be able to try this one. You're going to have to try it.
I've got a small Meyer lemon in a container, and I'm not going to say if I have or haven't tried it.
Now that's a... Wow. Okay.
Just got weird. All right, one more before we go. Okay. Talking to your plants helps them grow.
Okay, I've seen the science on this, and I think that one's true.
It's true, absolutely. Yeah, true and
because
true.
They are a living thing, and I don't know, there's just something about the connectedness of it all that they communicate, and maybe they understand we're communicating with them too.
You know what, some of it, just to like talk about that just a little bit, it has to do with the vibrations.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a connection with the wind, which also creates this kind of vibration and the different conditions. So it's all connected. Just like you said, it's all connected. And I've always believed that. It's like, mm-hmm. And you hear it and you see someone doing it, it's like, that's a little...
But it's true. Yeah. That music can also do it. Yeah.
No, you're fine. Yeah. I may do it a little bit here and there, especially when one's not looking so great and I've done everything I possibly can. And then sometimes, just nothing you can do about certain things. It's like, nature's going to do what it's going to do, and you can just, try to do little things along the way here, there. But as I found out, you can do everything right, but things will still go wrong in your you're not in control, especially when it comes to nature. You're just not in control.
Oh.
Yeah. All right, but we're going to wrap it up. And thank you for joining me once again. And everyone knows where they can find me, and they know where they can find you
by hiding.
Contact me. Oh, yeah. That's me sometimes, hiding in a fetal position
with
plants as the summer season starts to ramp up here.
Standing outside with an umbrella. Got it.
Yes. Looking, searching for pests. Thank you so much. This has been fun as usual. And I will see you next time.
See you next time. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Hey everybody, this is Tony with the Grounded Podcast. Make sure to follow and share the show. Share the show via your social media, friends, and family. And leave a 5 or 4 star review to help us move up in the charts. And by the way, stars 1 through 3 no longer work. Another way you can help the podcast to grow is by subscribing to the podcast for just $2.99 a month. Just basically the cost of a cup of coffee, right? And you can also follow us on Instagram @groundedpodcast_. Thank you so much.